and showed the ruffle of a red taffeta petticoat. "You took long enough about wearing it," grumbled Rhett, but his black eyes laughed and danced. "Yes, sir? Too long." Then Rhett said something that Wade didn't understand. "No more mule in horse harness?" "Miss Rhett, Miss Scarlet was bad to tell you that. You ain't holding that against this old nigger." "No, I'm not holding it. I just wanted to know." "Have another drink, Mammy. Have the whole bottle. Drink up, Wade. Give us a toast."
"To Sissy," cried Wade,
and gulped the liquid down. Choking, he began to cough and hiccup, and the other two laughed and beat him on the back. From the moment his daughter was born, Rhett's conduct was puzzling to all observers, and he upset many settled notions about himself, notions which both the town and Scarlet were loath to surrender. Whoever would have thought that he of all people would be so shamelessly, so openly proud of fatherhood? Especially in view of the embarrassing circumstance that his firstborn was a girl and not a boy. The novelty of fatherhood did not wear off. This caused some secret envy among women whose husbands took offspring for granted, long before the children were christened. He buttonholed people on the street and related details of his child's miraculous progress without even prefacing his remarks with the hypocritical but polite, "I know everyone thinks their own child is smart, but..." He thought his daughter marvelous, not to be compared with lesser brats, and he didn't care who knew it. When the new nurse permitted the baby to suck a bit of fat pork, thereby bringing on the first attack of colic, Rhett's conduct sent seasoned fathers and mothers into gales of laughter. He hurriedly summoned Dr. Meade and two other doctors, and with difficulty he was restrained from beating the unfortunate nurse with his crop. The nurse was discharged, and thereafter followed a series of nurses who remained, at the most, a week. None of them was good enough to satisfy the exacting requirements Rhett laid down. Mammy likewise viewed with displeasure the nurses that came and went, for she was jealous of any strange Negro, and saw no reason why she couldn't care for the baby, and Wade, and Ella, too. But Mammy was showing her age, and rheumatism was slowing her lumbering tread. Rhett lacked the courage to cite these reasons for employing another nurse. He told her instead that a man of his position couldn't afford to have only one nurse. It didn't look well. He would hire two others to do the drudgery and leave her as Mammy in chief. This Mammy understood very well. More servants were a credit to her position as well as Rhett's. But she wouldn't, she told him firmly, have any trashy free-issue niggers in her nursery. So Rhett sent to Tara for Prissy. He knew her shortcomings, but after all, she was a family darky, and Uncle Peter produced a great-niece named Lou, who had belonged to one of Miss Pitty's Burr cousins. Even before Scarlet was able to be about again, she noticed Rhett's preoccupation with the baby, and was somewhat nettled and embarrassed at his pride in her in front of callers. It was all very well for a man to love his child, but she felt there was something unmanly in the display of such love. He should be offhand and careless, as other men were.
"You're making a fool of yourself," she said irritably, "and I don't see why."
"No. Well, you wouldn't. The reason is that she's the first person who's ever belonged utterly to me."
"She belongs to me, too."
"No, you have two other children. She's mine."
"Great balls of fire," said Scarlet. "I had the baby, didn't I?" "Besides, honey, I belong to you."
Rhett looked at her over the black head of the child and smiled oddly. "Do you, my dear?" Only the entrance of Melanie stopped one of those swift, hot quarrels, which seemed to spring up so easily between them these days. Scarlett swallowed her wrath and watched Melanie take the baby. The name agreed upon for the child was Eugenia Victoria. But that afternoon Melanie unwittingly bestowed a name that clung, even as Pitypat had blotted out all memory of Sarah Jane. Rhett, leaning over the child, had said, "Her eyes are going to be pea green." "Indeed they are not," cried Melanie indignantly, forgetting that Scarlett's eyes were almost that shade. "They're going to be blue, like Mr. O'Hara's eyes, as blue as the bonny blue flag."
"Bonny blue butler," laughed Rhett.
Taking the child from her and peering more closely into the small eyes. And bonny she became until even her parents didn't recall that she had been named for two queens. Chapter 51. When she was finally able to go out again, Scarlett had Lou lace her into her stays as tightly as the strings would pull. Then she passed the tape measure about her waist. 20 inches! She groaned aloud. That was what having babies did to your figure. Her waist was as large as Aunt Pitty's, as large as Mammy's.
"Pull them tighter, Lou. See if you can't make it 18.5 inches, or I can't get into any of my dresses."
"It'll bust de strings," said Lou. "Your waist just done got bigger, Miss Scarlett, and there ain't nothing to do about it."
There is something to do about it, thought Scarlett,
as she ripped savagely at the seams of her dress to let out the necessary inches.
"I just won't have any more babies."
Of course, Bonnie was pretty and a credit to her, and Rhett adored the child. But she wouldn't have another baby. Just how she would manage this, she didn't know, for she couldn't handle Rhett as she had Frank. Rhett wasn't afraid of her. It would probably be difficult with Rhett acting so foolishly about Bonnie, and probably wanting a son next year. For all that, he said he'd drown any boy she gave him. Well, she wouldn't give him a boy or girl, either. 3 children were enough for any woman to have. When Lou had stitched up the ripped seams, pressed them smooth and buttoned Scarlett into the dress, she called the carriage, and Scarlett set out for the lumber yard. Her spirits rose as she went, and she forgot about her waistline, for she was going to meet Ashley at the yard, to go over the books with him. And if she was lucky, she might see him alone. She hadn't seen him since long before Bonnie was born. She hadn't wanted to see him at all when she was so obviously pregnant. And she had so missed the daily contact with him, even if there was always someone around. She had missed the importance and activity of her lumber business while she was immured. Of course, she didn't have to work now. She could easily sell the mills and invest the money for Wade and Ella. But that would mean she would hardly ever see Ashley, except in a formal social way with crowds of people around. And working by Ashley's side was her greatest pleasure. When she drove up to the yard, she saw with interest how high the piles of lumber were and how many customers were standing among them, talking to Hugh Elsing. And there were 6 mule teams and wagons being loaded by the Negro drivers. 6 teams, she thought, with pride. And I did this all by myself. Ashley came to the door of the little office, his eyes joyful with the pleasure of seeing her again, and he handed her out of her carriage and into the office as if she were a queen. But some of her pleasure was dimmed when she went over the books of his mill and compared them with Johnny Gallagher's books. Ashley had barely made expenses, and Johnny had a remarkable sum to his credit. She forbore to say anything as she looked at the 2 sheets. But Ashley read her face. Scarlet, I'm sorry. All I can say is that I wish you'd let me hire free darkies instead of using convicts. I believe I could do better.
Darkies? Why, their pay would break us. Convicts are dirt cheap. If Johnny can make this much with them.
Ashley's eyes went over her shoulder, looking at something she couldn't see. And the glad light went out of his eyes. I can't work convicts like Johnny Gallagher. I can't drive men.
God's nightgown. Johnny's a wonder at it. Ashley, you are just too soft-hearted. You ought to get more work out of them. Johnny told me that any time a malingerer wanted to get out of work, he told you he was sick, and you gave him a day off. Good Lord, Ashley, that's no way to make money. A couple of licks will cure most any sickness short of a broken leg.
Scarlet, Scarlet, stop. I can't bear to hear you talk that way, cried Ashley, his eyes coming back to her with a fierceness that stopped her short. Don't you realize that they are men? Some of them sick, underfed, miserable, and... Oh, my dear, I can't bear to see the way he has brutalized you, you who were always so sweet.
Who has wanted me?
I've got to say it, and I haven't any right, but I've got to say it. You're... Rhett Butler. Everything he touches, he poisons. And he has taken you, who were so sweet and generous and gentle, for all your spirited ways. And he has done this to you, hardened you, brutalized you by his contact.
Oh,
breathed Scarlet, guilt struggling with joy that Ashley should feel so deeply about her, should still think her sweet. Thank God he thought Rhett to blame for her penny-pinching ways. Of course Rhett had nothing to do with it, and the guilt was hers, but after all, another black mark on Rhett could do him no harm. If it were any other man in the world, I wouldn't care so much. But Rhett Butler, I've seen what he's done to you. Without your realizing it, he's twisted your thoughts into the same hard path his own run in. Oh, yes, I know I shouldn't say this. He saved my life, and I'm grateful, but I wish to God it had been any other man but him. And I haven't the right to talk to you like...
Oh, Ashley, you have the right. No one else has.
I tell you, I can't bear it, seeing your fineness coarsened by him, knowing that your beauty and your charm are in the keeping of a man who... When I think of him touching you, I...
He's going to kiss me, thought Scarlet ecstatically.
And it won't be my fault. She swayed toward him. But he drew back suddenly, as if realizing he had said too much, said things he never intended to say. I apologize most humbly, Scarlet. I've been insinuating that your husband is not a gentleman, and my own words have proved that I'm not one. No one has a right to criticize a husband to a wife. I haven't any excuse except... He faltered, and his face twisted. She waited, breathless. I haven't any excuse at all.
All the way home in the carriage, Scarlet's mind raced. No excuse at all, except that he loved her. And the thought of her lying in Rhett's arms roused a fury in him that she didn't think possible. Well, she could understand that. If it wasn't for the knowledge that his relations with Melanie were necessarily those of brother and sister, her own life would be a torment. And Rhett's embraces coarsened her, brutalized her. Well, if Ashley thought that, she could do very well without those embraces. She thought how sweet and romantic it would be for them both to be physically true to each other, even though married to other people. The idea possessed her imagination, and she took pleasure in it. And then, too, there was the practical side of it. It would mean that she wouldn't have to have any more children. When she reached home and dismissed the carriage, some of the exultation which had filled her at Ashley's words began to fade,
As she faced the prospect of telling Rhett that she wanted separate bedrooms, and all which that implied, it would be difficult. Moreover, how could she tell Ashley that she had denied herself to Rhett because of his wishes? What earthly good was a sacrifice if no one knew about it? What a burden modesty and delicacy were. If she could only talk to Ashley as frankly as she could to Rhett. Well, no matter. She'd insinuate the truth to Ashley somehow. She went up the stairs, and opening the nursery door, found Rhett sitting beside Bonnie's crib with Ella up on his lap and Wade displaying the contents of his pocket to him. What a blessing Rhett liked children and made much of them. Some stepfathers were so bitter about children of former marriages. "I want to talk to you," she said, and passed on into their bedroom. Better have this over now, while her determination not to have any more children was hot within her. And while Ashley's love was giving her strength. "Rhett," she said abruptly, when he had closed the bedroom door behind him, "I've decided that I don't want any more children." If he was startled at her unexpected statement, he didn't show it. He lounged to a chair, and sitting down, tilted it back. "My pet, as I told you before Bonnie was born, it is immaterial to me whether you have one child or 20. How perverse of him to evade the issue so neatly, as if not caring whether children came had anything to do with their actual arrival. I think 3 are enough. I don't intend to have one every year."
"3 seems an adequate number."
"You know very well," she began, embarrassment making her cheeks red. "You know what I mean?"
"I do. Do you realize that I can divorce you for refusing me my marital rights?"
"You were just low enough to think of something like that," she cried, annoyed that nothing was going as she planned it. "If you had any chivalry, you'd be nice like... Well, look at Ashley Wilkes. Melanie can't have any children, and he..."
"Quite the little gentleman, Ashley," said Rhett, and his eyes began to gleam oddly. "Pray go on with your discourse."
Scarlet choked, for her discourse was at its end, and she had nothing more to say. Now she saw how foolish had been her hope of amicably settling so important a matter, especially with a selfish swine like Rhett.
"You've been to the lumber office this afternoon, haven't you?"
"What has that got to do with it?"
"You like dogs, don't you, Scarlet? Do you prefer them in kennels or mangers?" The allusion was lost on her, as the tide of her anger and disappointment rose. He got lightly to his feet, and coming to her, put his hand under her chin and jerked her face up to his. "What a child you are. You have lived with 3 men and still know nothing of men's natures. You seem to think they're like old ladies past the change of life."
He pinched her chin playfully, and his hand dropped away from her. One black eyebrow went up as he bent a cool, long look on her.
"Scarlet, understand this. If you and your bed still held any charms for me, no locks and no entreaties could keep me away. And I would have no sense of shame for anything I did, for I made a bargain with you. A bargain which I have kept, and you are now breaking. Keep your chaste bed, my dear."
"Do you mean to tell me," cried Scarlet indignantly, "that you don't care..."
"You have tired of me, haven't you? Well, men tire more easily than women. Keep your sanctity, Scarlet. It'll work no hardship on me. It doesn't matter." He shrugged and grinned. "Fortunately, the world is full of beds, and most of the beds are full of women."
"You mean you'd actually be so..."
"My dear, innocent. But of course. It's a wonder I haven't strayed long ere this.
I never held fidelity to be a virtue. I shall lock my door every night.
Why bother? If I wanted you, no lock would keep me out.
He turned, as though the subject were closed, and left the room. Scarlett heard him going back to the nursery, where he was welcomed by the children. She sat down abruptly. She had had her way. This was what she wanted, and Ashley wanted. But it wasn't making her happy. Her vanity was sore, and she was mortified at the thought that Rhett had taken it all so lightly, that he didn't want her, that he put her on the level of other women in other beds. She wished she could think of some delicate way to tell Ashley that she and Rhett were no longer actually man and wife. But she knew now she could not. It all seemed a terrible mess now, and she half-heartedly wished she had said nothing about it. She would miss the long, amusing conversations in bed with Rhett, when the ember of his cigar glowed in the dark. She would miss the comfort of his arms when she woke terrified from dreams that she was running through cold mist. Suddenly, she felt very unhappy, and leaning her head on the arm of the chair, she cried. Chapter 52. One rainy afternoon, when Bonnie was barely past her first birthday, Wade moped about the sitting room, occasionally going to the window and flattening his nose on the dripping pane. He was a slender, weedy boy, small for his 8 years, quiet almost to shyness, never speaking unless spoken to. He was bored, and obviously at loss for entertainment, for Ella was busy in the corner with her dolls. Scarlett was at her secretary muttering to herself, as she added a long column of figures. And Rhett was lying on the floor, swinging his watch by its chain, just out of Bonnie's reach. After Wade had picked up several books and let them drop with bangs and sighed deeply, Scarlett turned to him in irritation. "Heavens, Wade! Run out and play." "I can't. It's raining." "Is it? I hadn't noticed." "Well, do something. You make me nervous, fidgeting about. Go tell Pork to hitch up the carriage and take you over to play with Beau." "He isn't home," sighed Wade. "He's at Raoul Picard's birthday party." Raoul was the small son of Maybelle and Rene Picard. A detestable little brat, Scarlett thought. More like an ape than a child. "Well, you can go see anyone you want to. Run tell Pork." "Nobody's at home," answered Wade. "Everybody's at the party." The unspoken words, "everybody but me," hung in the air. But Scarlett, her mind on her account books, paid no heed. Rhett raised himself to a sitting posture and said, "Why aren't you at the party too, son?" Wade edged closer to him, scuffing one foot and looking unhappy.
"I wasn't invited, sir."
Rhett handed his watch into Bonnie's destructive grasp and rose lightly to his feet. "Leave those damn figures alone, Scarlett. Why wasn't Wade invited to this party?"
"For heaven's sakes, Rhett, don't bother me now. Ashley has gotten these accounts in an awful snarl. Oh, that party? Well, I think it's nothing unusual that Wade wasn't invited, and I wouldn't let him go if he had been. Don't forget that Raoul is Mrs. Merriweather's grandchild, and Mrs. Merriweather would as soon have a free-issue nigger in her sacred parlor as one of us." Rhett, watching Wade's face with meditative eyes, saw the boy flinch.
"Come here, son," he said, drawing the boy to him. "Would you like to be at that party?"
"No, sir," said Wade bravely, but his eyes fell.
"Hum. Tell me, Wade, do you go to little Joe Whiting's parties, or Frank Bunnell's, or Well, any of your playmates?
No, sir. I don't get invited to many parties.
Wait, you are lying, cried Scarlett, turning. You went to three last week, the Bart children's party, and the Gellerts, and the Hundens.
As choice a collection of mules in horse harness as you could group together, said Rhett, his voice going into a soft drawl. Did you have a good time at those parties? Speak up.
No, sir.
Why not?
I don't know, sir. Mammy says they're white trash.
I skin Mammy this minute, cried Scarlett, leaping to her feet. And as for you, Wade, talking so about Mother's friends.
The bar's telling the truth, and so is Mammy, said Rhett. But, of course, you've never been able to know the truth if you met it in the road. Don't bother, son. You don't have to go to any more parties you don't want to go to. Here. He pulled a bill from his pocket. Tell Pork to harness the carriage and take you downtown. Buy yourself some candy. A lot. Enough to give you a wonderful stomachache. Wade, beaming, pocketed the bill and looked anxiously toward his mother for confirmation. But she, with a pucker in her brows, was watching Rhett. He had picked Bonnie from the floor and was cradling her to him, her small face against his cheek. She couldn't read his face, but there was something in his eyes almost like fear. Fear and self-accusation. Wade, encouraged by his stepfather's generosity, came shyly toward him.
Uncle Rhett, can I ask you something?
Of course. Rhett's look was anxious, absent, as he held Bonnie's head closer. What is it, Wade?
Uncle Rhett, did you fight in the war?
Rhett's eyes came alertly back, and they were sharp. But his voice was casual. Why do you ask, son?
Well, Joe Whiting said you didn't, and so did Frankie Bunnell.
Ah, said Rhett. And what did you tell them? Wade looked unhappy.
I told them I didn't know.
And with a rush,
but I didn't care and I hit them. Were you in the war, Uncle Rhett?
Yes, said Rhett, suddenly violent. I was in the war. I was in the army for 8 months. I fought all the way from Lovejoy up to Franklin, Tennessee. And I was with Johnston when he surrendered. Wade wriggled with pride, but Scarlett laughed.
I thought you were ashamed of your war record, she said. Didn't you tell me to keep it quiet?
Hush, he said briefly. Does that satisfy you, Wade?
Oh, yes, sir. I knew you were in the war. I knew you weren't scared like they said, but why weren't you with the other little boys' fathers?
Because the other little boys' fathers were such fools they had to put them in the infantry. I was a West Pointer, and so I was in the artillery. In the regular artillery, Wade, not the home guard. It takes a pile of sense to be in the artillery, Wade.
I bet, said Wade, his face shining. Did you get wounded, Uncle Rhett?
Rhett hesitated.
Tell him about your dysentery,
jeered Scarlett. Rhett carefully set the baby on the floor and pulled his shirt and undershirt out of his trouser band. Come here, Wade. I'll show you where I was wounded.
Wade advanced, excited, and gazed where Rhett's finger pointed. A long raised scar ran across his brown chest and down into his heavily muscled abdomen. It was the souvenir of a knife fight in the California gold fields, but Wade didn't know it.
He breathed heavily and happily. I guess you're about as brave as my father, Uncle Rhett.
Almost, but not quite, said Rhett, stuffing his shirt into his trousers. Now go on and spend your dollar and wail hell out of any boy who says I wasn't in the army.
Wade went dancing out happily, calling to Pork. And Rhett picked up the baby again.
"Now why all these lies, my gallant soldier laddie?" asked Scarlet.
"A boy has to be proud of his father, or his stepfather. I can't let him be ashamed before the other little brutes, cruel creatures, children."
"Oh, fiddle-dee!"
"I never thought about what it meant to Wade," said Rhett slowly. "I never thought how he suffered. And it's not going to be that way for Bonnie."
"What way?"
"Do you think I'm going to have my Bonnie ashamed of her father? Have her left out of parties when she's 9 or 10? Do you think I'm going to have her humiliated like Wade for things that aren't her fault but yours and mine?"
"Oh, children's parties!"
"Out of children's parties grow young girls' debut parties. Do you think I'm going to let my daughter grow up outside of everything decent in Atlanta? I'm not going to send her north to school and to visit because she won't be accepted here or in Charleston or Savannah or New Orleans. And I'm not going to see her forced to marry a Yankee or a foreigner because no decent Southern family will have her. Because her mother was a fool and her father a blackguard."
Wade, who had come back to the door, was an interested but puzzled listener.
"Bonnie can marry Beau, Uncle Rhett."
The anger went from Rhett's face as he turned to the little boy, and he considered his words with apparent seriousness, as he always did when dealing with the children.
"That's true, Wade. Bonnie can marry Beau Wilkes. But who will you marry?"
"Oh, I shan't marry anyone," said Wade confidently, luxuriating in a man-to-man talk with the one person, except Aunt Millie, who never reproved and always encouraged him. "I'm going to go to Harvard and be a lawyer, like my father, and then I'm going to be a brave soldier, just like him."
"I wish Millie would keep her mouth shut," cried Scarlet.
"Wade, you are not going to Harvard. It's a Yankee school, and I won't have you going to a Yankee school. You are going to the University of Georgia. And after you graduate, you are going to manage the store for me. And as for your father being a brave soldier..."
"Hush," said Rhett curtly, not missing the shining light in Wade's eyes when he spoke of the father he had never known.
"You grow up and be a brave man like your father, Wade. Try to be just like him, for he was a hero, and don't let anyone tell you differently. He married your mother, didn't he? Well, that's proof enough of heroism. And I'll see that you go to Harvard and become a lawyer. Now run along and tell Pork to take you to town."
"I'll thank you to let me manage my children," cried Scarlet as Wade obediently trotted from the room.
"You're a damn poor manager. You've wrecked whatever chances Ella and Wade had, but I won't permit you to do Bonnie that way. Bonnie's going to be a little princess, and everyone in the world is going to want her. There's not going to be any place she can't go. Good God, do you think I'm going to let her grow up and associate with a riffraff that fills this house?
They're good enough for you, and a damn sight too good for you, my pet. But not for Bonnie. Do you think I'd let her marry any of this runagate gang you spend your time with? Irishmen on the make, Yankees, white trash, carpet-bag parvenus. My Bonnie with her butler blood and her Robillard strain.
The O'Haras
might have been kings of Ireland once, but your father was nothing but a smart mick on the make, and you are no better.
But then I'm at fault, too. I've gone through life like a bat out of hell, never caring what I did, because nothing ever mattered to me. But Bonnie matters. God, what a fool I've been. Bonnie wouldn't be received in Charleston, no matter what my mother or your Aunt Eulalia or Aunt Pauline did. And it's obvious that she won't be received here unless we do something quickly.
Oh, Rhett, you take it so seriously, you're funny. With our money, damn, our money.
All our money can't buy what I want for her. I'd rather Bonnie was invited to eat dry bread in the Picard's miserable house, or Mrs. Elsing's rickety barn, than to be the belle of a Republican inaugural ball. Scarlet, you've been a fool. You should have ensured a place for your children in the social scheme years ago, but you didn't. You didn't even bother to keep what position you had. And it's too much to hope that you'll mend your ways at this late date. You're too anxious to make money and too fond of bullying people.
I consider this whole affair a tempest in a teapot, said Scarlett coldly, rattling her papers to indicate that, as far as she was concerned, the discussion was finished.
We have only Mrs. Wilkes to help us, and you do your best to alienate and insult her. Oh, spare me your remarks about her poverty and her tacky clothes. She's the soul and the center of everything in Atlanta that's sterling. Thank God for her. She'll help me do something about it.
And what are you going to do?
Do? I'm going to cultivate every female dragon of the old guard in this town, especially Mrs. Merriweather, Mrs. Elsing, Mrs. Whiting, and Mrs. Meade. If I have to crawl on my belly to every fat old cat who hates me, I'll do it. I'll be meek under their coldness and repent of my evil ways. I'll contribute to their damned charities and I'll go to their damned churches. I'll admit and brag about my services to the Confederacy, and if worst comes to worst, I'll join the damned Klan. Though a merciful God could hardly lay so heavy a penance on my shoulders as that. And I shall not hesitate to remind the fools whose necks I've saved that they owe me a debt. And you, madam, will kindly refrain from undoing my work behind my back by foreclosing mortgages on any of the people I'm courting, or selling them rotten lumber, or in other ways insulting them. And Governor Bullock never sets foot in this house again, do you hear? And none of this gang of elegant thieves you've been associating with, either. If you do invite them over my request, you will find yourself in the embarrassing position of having no host in your home. If they come in this house, I will spend the time in Belle Watling's bar telling anyone who cares to hear that I won't stay under the same roof with them. Scarlett, who had been smarting under his words, laughed shortly.
So the riverboat gambler and the speculator is going to be respectable. Well, your first move toward respectability had better be the sale of Belle Watling's house.
That was a shot in the dark. She had never been absolutely certain that Rhett owned the house.
He laughed suddenly, as though he read her mind.
Thanks for the suggestion.
Had he tried, Rhett could not have chosen a more difficult time to beat his way back to respectability. Never before or after did the names Republican and Scalawag carry such odium. For now the corruption of the carpetbag regime was at its height. And since the surrender, Rhett's name had been inextricably linked with Yankees, Republicans, and Scalawags. Atlanta people had thought, with helpless fury, in 1866, that nothing could be worse than the harsh military rule they had then. But now, under Bullock, they were learning the worst. Thanks to the Negro vote, the Republicans and their allies were firmly entrenched, and they were riding roughshod over the powerless but still protesting minority. Word had been spread among the Negroes that there were only two political parties mentioned in the Bible, the publicans and the sinners. No Negro wanted to join a party made up entirely of sinners, so they hastened to join the Republicans. Their new masters voted them over and over again, electing poor whites and scalawags to high places, electing even some Negroes. These Negroes sat in the legislature, where they spent most of their time eating goobers and easing their unaccustomed feet into and out of new shoes. Few of them could read or write. They were fresh from cotton patch and canebrake. But it was within their power to vote taxes and bonds as well as enormous expense accounts to themselves and their Republican friends. And they voted them. The state staggered under taxes which were paid in fury, for the taxpayers knew that much of the money voted for public purposes was finding its way into private pockets. Completely surrounding the state capital was a host of promoters,
speculators, seekers after contracts, and others hoping to profit from the orgy of spending. And many were growing shamelessly rich. They had no difficulty at all in obtaining the state's money for building railroads that were never built, for buying cars and engines that were never bought, for erecting public buildings that never existed, except in the minds of their promoters. Bonds were issued running into the millions. Most of them were illegal and fraudulent, but they were issued just the same. The state treasurer, a Republican but an honest man, protested against the illegal issues and refused to sign them. But he and others who sought to check the abuses could do nothing against the tide that was running. The state-owned railroad had once been an asset to the state, but now it was a liability, and its debts had piled up to the million mark. It was no longer a railroad. It was an enormous bottomless trough in which the hogs could swill and wallow. Many of its officials were appointed for political reasons, regardless of their knowledge of the operation of railroads. There were three times as many people employed as were necessary. Republicans rode free on passes. Carloads of Negroes rode free on their happy jaunts about the state to vote and re-vote in the same elections. The mismanagement of the state road especially infuriated the taxpayers, for out of the earnings of the road was to come the money for free schools. But there were no earnings. There were only debts. And so there were no free schools. Few had money to send their children to pay schools. And there was a generation of children growing up in ignorance who would spread the seeds of illiteracy down the years. But far and above their anger at the waste and mismanagement and graft was the resentment of the people at the bad light in which the governor represented them in the North. When Georgia howled against corruption, the governor hastily went north, appeared before Congress, and told of white outrages against Negroes, of Georgia's preparation for another rebellion, and the need for a stern military rule in this state. No Georgian wanted trouble with the Negroes, and they tried to avoid trouble. No one wanted another war. No one wanted or needed bayonet rule. All Georgia wanted was to be let alone so the state could recuperate. But with the operation of what came to be known as the governor's slander mill, the North saw only a rebellious state that needed a heavy hand, and a heavy hand was laid upon it. It was a glorious spree for the gang which had Georgia by the throat. There was an orgy of grabbing, and over all there was a cold cynicism about open theft in high places that was chilling to contemplate. Protests and efforts to resist accomplished nothing, for the state government was being upheld and supported by the power of the United States Army. Atlanta cursed the name of Bullock and his scalawags and Republicans, and they cursed the name of anyone connected with them. And Rhett was connected with them. He had been in with them, so everyone said, in all their schemes. But now, he turned against the stream in which he had drifted so short a while before, and began swimming arduously back against the current. He went about his campaign slowly, subtly, not arousing the suspicions of Atlanta by the spectacle of a leopard trying to change his spots overnight. He avoided his dubious cronies and was seen no more in the company of Yankee officers, scalawags, and Republicans. He attended Democratic rallies, and he ostentatiously voted the Democratic ticket. He gave up high-stake card games and stayed comparatively sober. If he went to Belle Watling's house at all, he went by night and by stealth, as did more respectable townsmen, instead of leaving his horse hitched in front of her door in the afternoons as an advertisement of his presence within. And the congregation of the Episcopal Church almost fell out of their pews when he tiptoed in, late for services, with Wade's hand held in his. The congregation was as much stunned by Wade's appearance as by Rhett's, for the little boy was supposed to be a Catholic. At least, Scarlett was one. Or she was supposed to be one. But she hadn't put foot in the church in years. for religion had gone from her as many of Ellen's other teachings had gone.
Everyone thought she had neglected her boy's religious education, and thought more of Rhett for trying to rectify the matter, even if he did take the boy to the Episcopal Church instead of the Catholic. Rhett could be grave of manner and charming when he chose to restrain his tongue and keep his black eyes from dancing maliciously. It had been years since he had chosen to do this, but he did it now, putting on gravity and charm, even as he put on waistcoats of more sober hues. It wasn't difficult to gain a foothold of friendliness with the men who owed their necks to him. They would have showed their appreciation long ago, had Rhett not acted as if their appreciation were a matter of small moment. Now, Hugh Elsing, Renee, the Simmons boys, Andy Bunnell, and the others found him pleasant, diffident about putting himself forward, and embarrassed when they spoke of the obligation they owed him. "It was nothing," he would protest. "In my place, you'd have all done the same thing." He subscribed handsomely to the fund for the repairs of the Episcopal Church, and he gave a large, but not vulgarly large, contribution to the Association for the Beautification of the Graves of Our Glorious Dead. He sought out Mrs. Elsing to make this donation, and embarrassedly begged that she keep his gift a secret, knowing very well that this would spur her to spreading the news. Mrs. Elsing hated to take his money. Speculator money. But the association needed money badly. "I don't see why you, of all people, should be subscribing," she said acidly. When Rhett told her with a proper sober mien that he was moved to contribute by the memories of former comrades in arms, braver than he but less fortunate, who now lay in unmarked graves, Mrs. Elsing's aristocratic jaw dropped. Dolly Merriweather had told her Scarlett had said Captain Butler was in the army, but, of course, she hadn't believed it. Nobody had believed it. "You? In the army? What was your company? Your regiment?" Rhett gave them. "Oh, the artillery. Everyone I knew was either in the cavalry or the infantry. Then that explains..." She broke off, disconcerted, expecting to see his eyes snap with malice. But he only looked down and toyed with his watch chain. "I would have liked the infantry," he said, passing completely over her insinuation. "But when they found out that I was a West Pointer, though I didn't graduate, Mrs. Elsing, due to a boyish prank, they put me in the artillery. The regular artillery, not the militia. They needed men with specialized knowledge in that last campaign. You know how heavy the losses had been, so many artillerymen killed. It was pretty lonely in the artillery. I didn't see a soul I knew. I don't believe I saw a single man from Atlanta during my whole service." "Well," said Mrs. Elsing, confused. "If he had been in the army, then she was in the wrong." She had made many sharp remarks about his cowardice, and the memory of them made her feel guilty. "Well, and why haven't you ever told anybody about your service? You act as though you were ashamed of it." Rhett looked her squarely in the eyes, his face blank. "Mrs. Elsing," he said earnestly, "believe me when I say that I am prouder of my services to the Confederacy than of anything I have ever done or will do. I feel...
"Well, why did you keep it hidden?"
"I was ashamed to speak of it in the light of some of my former actions." Mrs. Elsing reported the contribution and the conversation in detail to Mrs. Merriweather.
"And, Dolly, I give you my word that when he said that about being ashamed, tears came into his eyes. Yes, tears. I nearly cried myself."
"Stuff and nonsense," cried Mrs. Merriweather in disbelief. "I don't believe tears came into his eyes any more than I believe he was in the army. And I can find out mighty quick. If he was in that artillery outfit, I can get at the truth.
for Colonel Carlton, who commanded it, married the daughter of one of my grandfather's sisters, and I'll write him." She wrote Colonel Carlton, and to her consternation received a reply praising Rhett's services in no uncertain terms. A born artilleryman, a brave soldier, and an uncomplaining gentleman, a modest man who wouldn't even take a commission when it was offered him.
"Well," said Mrs. Merriweather, showing the letter to Mrs. Elsing, "you can knock me down with a feather. Maybe we did misjudge the scamp about not being a soldier. Maybe we should have believed what Scarlett and Melanie said about him enlisting the day the town fell. But just the same, he's a scalawag and a rascal, and I don't like him."
"Somehow," said Mrs. Elsing uncertainly, "somehow, I don't think he's so bad. A man who fought for the Confederacy can't be all bad. It's Scarlett who's the bad one. Do you know, Dolly, I really believe that he... well, that he's ashamed of Scarlett, but is too much of a gentleman to let on."
"Ashamed? Pooh! They're both cut out of the same piece of cloth. Where did you ever get such a silly notion?"
"It isn't silly," said Mrs. Elsing indignantly. "Yesterday, in the pouring rain, he had those three children, even the baby, mind you, out in his carriage riding them up and down Peachtree Street, and he gave me a lift home. And when I said, 'Captain Butler, have you lost your mind keeping these children out in the damp? Why don't you take them home?' And he didn't say a word, but just looked embarrassed. But Mammy spoke up and said, 'The house full of white trash, and it healthier for the children in the rain than at home.'"
"What did he say?"
"What could he say? He just scowled at Mammy and passed it over. You know, Scarlett was giving a big whist party yesterday afternoon with all those common, ordinary women there. I guess he didn't want them kissing his baby."
"Well," said Mrs. Merriweather, wavering but still obstinate.
But the next week, she, too, capitulated. Rhett now had a desk in the bank. What he did at this desk, the bewildered officials of the bank didn't know. But he owned too large a block of the stock for them to protest his presence there. After a while, they forgot that they had objected to him, for he was quiet and well-mannered and actually knew something about banking and investments. At any rate, he sat at his desk all day, giving every appearance of industry, for he wished to be on equal terms with his respectable fellow townsmen who worked, and worked hard. Mrs. Merriweather, wishing to expand her growing bakery, had tried to borrow $2,000 from the bank with her house as security. She had been refused because there were already two mortgages on the house. The stout old lady was storming out of the bank when Rhett stopped her, learned the trouble, and said worriedly, "But there must be some mistake, Mrs. Merriweather. Some dreadful mistake. You, of all people, shouldn't have to bother about collateral. Why, I'd lend you money just on your word. Any lady who could build up the business you've built up is the best risk in the world. The bank wants to lend money to people like you. Now do sit down right here in my chair, and I will attend to it for you." When he came back, he was smiling blandly, saying that there had been a mistake, just as he had thought. The $2,000 was right there waiting for her whenever she cared to draw against it. Now, about her house, would she just sign right here? Mrs. Merriweather, torn with indignation and insult, furious that she had to take this favor from a man she disliked and distrusted, was hardly gracious in her thanks. But he failed to notice it. As he escorted her to the door, he said, "Mrs. Merriweather, I have always had a great regard for your knowledge, and I wonder if you could tell me something." The plumes on her bonnet barely moved as she nodded. "What did you do when your Maybelle was little and she sucked her thumb?"
"What?"
"My Bonnie sucks a thumb. I can't make her stop it."
You should make her stop it, said Mrs. Merriweather vigorously. It will ruin the shape of her mouth.
I know, and she has a beautiful mouth. But I don't know what to do.
Well, Scarlet ought to know, said Mrs. Merriweather shortly. She's had two other children.
Rhett looked down at his shoes and sighed. I've tried putting soap under her fingernails, he said, passing over her remark about Scarlet.
Soap? Bah! Soap is no good at all. I put quinine on Maybelle's thumb, and let me tell you, Captain Butler, she stopped sucking that thumb mighty quick.
Quinine? I would never have thought of it. I can't thank you enough, Mrs. Merriweather. It was worrying me.
He gave her a smile, so pleasant, so grateful, that Mrs. Merriweather stood uncertainly for a moment. But as she told him goodbye, she was smiling too. She hated to admit to Mrs. Elsing that she had misjudged the man, but she was an honest person, and she said there had to be something good about a man who loved his child. What a pity Scarlet took no interest in so pretty a creature as Bonnie. There was something pathetic about a man trying to raise a little girl all by himself. Rhett knew very well the pathos of the spectacle. And if it blackened Scarlet's reputation, he didn't care. From the time the child could walk, he took her about with him constantly, in the carriage or in front of his saddle. When he came home from the bank in the afternoon, he took her walking down Peachtree Street, holding her hand, slowing his long strides to her toddling steps, patiently answering her thousand questions. People were always in their front yards or on their porches at sunset, and as Bonnie was such a friendly, pretty child, with her tangle of black curls and her bright blue eyes, few could resist talking to her. Rhett never presumed on these conversations, but stood by, exuding fatherly pride, and gratification at the notice taken of his daughter. Atlanta had a long memory, and was suspicious and slow to change. Times were hard, and feeling was bitter against anyone who had had anything to do with Bullock and his crowd. But Bonnie had the combined charm of Scarlet and Rhett at their best, and she was the small opening wedge Rhett drove into the wall of Atlanta's coldness. Bonnie grew rapidly, and every day it became more evident that Gerald O'Hara had been her grandfather. She had short, sturdy legs, and wide eyes of Irish blue, and a small square jaw that went with a determination to have her own way. She had Gerald's sudden temper, to which she gave vent in screaming tantrums, that were forgotten as soon as her wishes were gratified. And as long as her father was near her, they were always gratified hastily. He spoiled her despite all the efforts of Mammy and Scarlet, for in all things she pleased him, except one. And that was her fear of the dark. Until she was 2 years old, she went to sleep readily in the nursery she shared with Wade and Ella. Then, for no apparent reason, she began to sob whenever Mammy waddled out of the room, carrying the lamp. From this, she progressed to wakening in the late night hours, screaming with terror, frightening the two other children and alarming the house. Once Dr. Mead had to be called, and Rhett was short with him when he diagnosed only bad dreams. All anyone could get from her was one word. Dark. Scarlet was inclined to be irritated with the child and favored a spanking. She wouldn't humor her by leaving a lamp burning in the nursery, for then Wade and Ella would be unable to sleep. Rhett, worried but gentle, attempting to extract further information from his daughter, said coldly that if any spanking were done, he would do it personally and to Scarlet. The upshot of the situation was that Bonnie was removed from the nursery to the room Rhett now occupied alone. Her small bed was placed beside his large one, and a shaded lamp burned on the table all night long. The town buzzed when this story got about. Somehow there was something indelicate about a girl child sleeping in her father's room, even though the girl was only 2 years old. Scarlett suffered from this gossip in two ways.